Hello, dear listeners. John Moe here. Great episode of Depression Mode coming up. Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me will be my guest, and some other special guests coming up, too. But first, I want to tell you that we are currently in the Max Fund Drive. It's our annual funding drive. It's how we pay for the show. It's how the show exists. We know a lot of you are really enjoying Depression Mode. You count on it. It's part of your life. It helps explain some things. It helps you connect with other people. Well, it costs money to make it and bring it to you. So it needs support. Support it, it will be there. No support, no show. I'm not asking you to pay for the whole thing, but just like 10 bucks a month. You get some cool thank you gifts, more about those a little later in the episode, and you make a positive change in the world. You build the show. You make it exist, succeed, grow. We can only do it with your help. Go to MaximumFun.org/join. Hello, Peter Sagal.
Hello, John Moe.
How are you?
Oh.
It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Several years ago now, I went out for drinks one night with my friend Peter Sagal and a couple of other pals. Peter is the host of the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And that night, Peter did most of the talking. He told us about the ugliest divorce I had ever heard about. His divorce. He didn't tell me everything, of course, and it was clearly not a matter of one side being right and the other side being wrong. Divorces are more complicated than that. I've been around long enough in this world to see some divorces go smoothly, even some that were friendly and positive, and some that went bad. But in terms of ones that go bad, this was the worst. His ex-wife wouldn't speak to him, and his three daughters stopped speaking to him as well. He didn't just lose a marriage, he lost an entire family. Peter wasn't looking for advice that night. We didn't provide any. He just wanted to lay his burdens down. They were heavy burdens. Then, a few years after that, Peter was my first guest on my old podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression, where he revealed for the first time publicly that he had been dealing with depression for a long time. And that fact, plus the divorce, which had concluded by that point, had really kicked his ass. Hearing Peter talk about things like this surprised a lot of people who only knew him from his chipper, clever self on the radio.
We have a wonderful show for you today because we are going to fix Washington. By which I mean, one of the great disappointments about Washington is that it's nothing like the West Wing. We want the real Washington to have snappy dialogue, the soaring speeches, the perfect comebacks, and then we want it to be canceled.
And of course, that radio version of Peter, that Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me version, is part of his real personality. It's just one side, though. You got to remember, people with depression don't sound like Eeyore all the time. That's not how it works. Everyone should know that. They are often the energetic, smiling people you would never suspect. Because depression isn't a mood or a momentary response, it's a mental disorder. All right, so let's catch up to the present. I knew Peter had remarried, and late last year, he became the father to a brand new baby boy. And he is joyful about this. The daughters from his first marriage, they still don't speak to him. That pain is large and constant, and how could it not be? So when I spoke to Peter Sagal in February, after all that, and a year into COVID, I was wondering how he was doing. A warning, we do talk about suicide in this episode.
I'm actually fine. I'm genuinely fine for a lot of reasons, some of which we can get into. But also because of perspective, one of the nice things about an international catastrophe is you find out how lucky you really are. And so I'm much better off than many, many other people, which I'm reminded of every day. Nobody in my family has become sick. In fact, we're all pretty healthy. I still have my job. And so this and that, I still have housing, you know, so that puts me at like the top 5% of all humans. And so I can't complain.
have you had any kind of roller coaster, any kind of ups and downs throughout this? Because I was fine in March, but yeah. I'm a very different person than I am now.
We were just talking about that. We had our, just before I got on with you, we had our weekly check-in for Wait as we start our week. And we were talking about the fact like, yeah, back in March, this seemed like it might be fun, right? Like, oh, we're going to go into lockdown. Everybody's got to stay home. We're going to watch a lot of Netflix. And then, you know, we came up with these wonderful sort of Zoom things. Oh, this is cool. And we all felt like this will be great. It'll be like the London Blitz.
Right.
And we'll all talk someday about how we all surf. We all pulled together. But it's been coming up on a year. And what's weird is, and I don't know if you've had this experience where you say, oh, last year I did X, or remember when last year we went there, and it's not last year, it's 2019, because 2020 just disappeared.
Just didn't happen.
We didn't do anything to mark the time. Therefore, it's hard to remember that it happened.
I had a goal of watching every Hitchcock film.
We all had goals.
All the Hitchcock films I hadn't seen. And my list over almost a year has ended up being Rear Window, a movie I had already seen.
Well, I was going to learn to play the piano. We all had dreams.
So I talked to you a few years ago, kind of kicked off this whole idea of talking about depression and mental obstacles, whoopsies.
Whoopsies, yeah.
That was in 2016. I wanted to call you back because your life seems so different now
from
what it was then.
Yeah.
So set the table a little bit. Where was your head at when I talked to you 4.5 years ago?
My head was, in a bathysphere at the bottom of the sea, I think. So just to set the scene, if I remember correctly, was it the end of 2016 or the very beginning of 2016?
I think we talked in like August, like late August.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
In 2016, I had just finished legally a 3-year long saga of divorce, which I've talked about in other contexts, including your show, but suffice to say it was pretty bad. And not for the usual reasons that divorces are bad, i.e. it wasn't so much that my relationship with my ex-wife was over, that was fine, it should have been over, I think we both agree on that. It was that my relationship with my 3 daughters, who at that time were teenagers, was profoundly damaged. And that was very, very difficult in ways that, let me put it this way. It's something I've learned it's best not to talk about for a variety of reasons. One of them being that the more I talk about it, the worse I feel. But there are also other issues of like their privacy. They're, 2 of them are now legal adults. They're in the world. And I don't feel right talking about what happened in their childhood without their, you know, permission, cooperation. So I'll just leave it there. But it was very, very bad. Suffice to say, and this may come up again in our conversation, I felt a little bit like I was living a combination of the Book of Job as written by Franz Kafka. And what I mean by that, I know, not good. What I mean by that is, as with Job, everything that I had thought I had, a family, you know, children, whatever, had been suddenly and taken away from me. And it was Kafka because it was somehow my fault, but I couldn't figure out why. And so it was very hard. 5 years later is 2021. I am extremely happily remarried and I have a child, a new child, another child, a son who was just born in the end of November of 2020. Even as I speak, he's upstairs with his mommy. And so, yeah, it's really quite remarkable. So I used to be pretty upset about the Book of Job and everything else that is descended from it, including such important works of world literature as How the Grinch Stole Christmas and Jerry Maguire. And the reason is that all of those are stories of people who lose everything. In the case of Job, his cattle, his children, his wealth. In the case of Jerry Maguire, his career as a sports agent. And in the case of The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, The Who's Christmas. People find out these things are not that important, which is the lesson, right? You know, is to quote the Who's, it came without, maybe, what is the line? Maybe Christmas didn't come in the package. After all, you know, lot, and they all sing anyway, right? But then what happens at the end of all those stories is the protagonists who have learned that lesson that the thing they thought was important isn't really important, get the thing back anyway, right? Jerry Maguire ends.
So they could appreciate it more.
They can appreciate it more, but they still get it back. So like the Who's, who the whole lesson of The Grinch Who Stole Christmas is that the Whos don't have their roast beast and they have Christmas anyway, but they get their roast beast too, right? And this really bothered me because I had been trained by a lifetime of exposure to these stories to expect that the happy ending was I'd get everything back.
Right.
And guess what? That doesn't actually happen. You don't get back what you've lost. But this is what I have discovered, that there are such things as happy endings. The happy ending is you move on and get something else. That perspective allows me to understand how incredibly fortunate I am.
I've often talked about that, how we're a storytelling culture, and we expect life to be like TV and movies because
yes.
That's our understanding of experiences. And as you know, having written in those fields, there's a formula that you're supposed to follow.
Right.
You know, the producers will tell you, follow this formula. Like, you know, here's the hero. Then they go on a journey, and then they face this enormous task at the beginning of Act 3. And I find that talking with people about mental health, they kind of expect, then I'll face the worst of it, and then I'll be fine.
Right.
And I just say, oh, I have terrible news.
Yes.
It's not going to work at all.
Yeah. And believe me, I can't tell you how angry I got sometimes. I ended up during the darkest days, which are go back to at least point to 2013 on. I mean, I felt like I was staring at these TV shows and various things in my apartment where I lived by myself and feeling like Elvis Presley watching Robert Goulet. I just wanted to shoot the goddamn TV because it was so annoying. And there is this expectation that, and there is a particular, by the way, subgenre of this that specifically has to do with children alienated from parents due to a difficult divorce. There is so much of that. There's the movie Taken, for example. It turns out all you need to do is for her to be kidnapped by what we used to quaintly call white slavers, and then he would go and use his skills, and you get to save her, and then everything's fine. And even though you are not an international spy, an assassin, you somehow feel that that will happen, right? Because that's how the stories go. The story begins with a parent estranged from a child. It will end with them reconciling through assassination, through finding an abandoned fighting robot in the movie Real Steel. I mean, there are a lot of examples. And it turns out those are very nice stories, but they don't reflect the truth.
When that was happening, the depression that you had experienced had been kind of laying dormant for a while. And then...
Yeah.
And then earthquakes and volcanoes.
Earthquakes and volcanoes. And we talked about that when I was on your earlier podcast, which is weird because one of the ways you can talk about depression, there are many ways, and you have been exploring all of them, but one of the ways you can talk about it is making very large, menacing mountains out of small molehills.
Yes.
That's one of the symptoms. Things that are just completely unimportant become extraordinarily important as long as you can inflate them in such a way as to make yourself look or feel bad. And one of the things that is, shall we say, interesting for a person prone to that perspective is that if when all of a sudden you're faced with a real mountain, to extend the metaphor, what do you do then? And at least in my case, and it's very important never to generalize to everybody else, but at least in my case, it didn't magnify my depression as much as put it into appropriate perspective. Another pop culture analogy is how Tony Soprano, who is depressed when we meet him in season one, is somehow revived by the attempt to kill him. And in that story, there's this sense of like he can only be alive and feel energized when he's in combat, maybe. But there's also a sense of, oh, here's a real problem. And so in addition to finally seeking treatment before all this began, I found I didn't have enough time to be like depressed because I, well, frankly, had people who were at least metaphorically trying to kill me. So it focused the mind in a way that was at least, if not useful for me, I don't want to say it did me a lot of good. It preserved me in a way that I would not have expected.
So then what was the road ahead? You know, you're faced with this mountain. Did you see a path before you on how you could...
Absolutely not.
You could make your life better?
Absolutely not. I did not see, and that was one of the reasons it was so difficult to deal with, is that I could not see, as we've been discussing, any way to that happy ending. But what I could eventually figure out, and I in fact ended up writing a whole book about this,
is that if I could get through each day, then tomorrow I could see what happened. And if you're hearing an analogy to recovery, that's probably not an accident. I think I adopted some of that mentality. If everything seems impossible, if you cannot see any end to the darkness, then don't think about that. Don't think about how this is all going to end. Just get through the day. Just get through the day. And
so it was a day at a time.
It was very much one day at a time. Like, and I don't want to be too bleak, but especially considering who I'm talking to and the concerns that you've written about at great length. But there were some days it was like, well, I won't kill myself today. I'll just get through the day. It'll be, you know, it's not going to be any better tomorrow, but I'll get through it today. And I did. And in a weird way, that attitude of like not learning to not expect anything. And believe me, I had to have many expectations shattered over and over and over and over again before I finally arrived at the fact like nothing good is going to happen, but get up every day and do what you needed to do anyway. And then tomorrow we'll see.
More with Peter Sagal just ahead, but first, joining us during the Max Fund drive to talk about the importance of supporting what you love, being a part of this show, being on the Depression Mode team, is Mr. Maximum Fund himself, the founder of the network, my good friend, Mr. Jesse Thorne. Hey, Jesse.
Hi, John. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great because this is the time when people are coming out in support of what we're doing on Depression Mode, and the support is kind of built into the reason for having the show. Like so many times, conversations about mental health and about mental illness are ones that people have kept a little hush-hush, but it doesn't have to be that way. And more people are recognizing that. They're talking on our show, and we are telling people that this is how it works. It exists because you support it. And I got to say, I'm so happy to be a part of Maximum Fun. It is the perfect place for me. I feel so welcome, so at home, and I feel like we're really doing some good in the world together.
This is a show that you created. This is a show that you're making on your terms for the benefit of you and the folks who want it, the folks who are listening right now.
You know, and part of what attracted me to Maximum Fun and part of why every radio colleague I knew kept saying, go over to Maximum Fun and do some stuff, is that the idea of you're creating something, you're doing some good in the world, you're in it for the right reasons, you're not trying to take over the world, you're not trying to be dominant and defeat all the other shows. You're trying to make something that people can use and that people can be a part of.
John, the reason that I always think of when I think of why Maximum Fun is supported by members rather than supported through some other means is that at the end of the day, you know, there are a lot of ways to make a living doing this. Mm-hmm. They're all similarly difficult. But for me, I always just thought, well, I would rather work for the people who listen to the show.
Yeah.
Ultimately, what keeps the lights on for us, what will keep the lights on for Depression Mode and John is membership, you know, joining this community at Maximum Fun. And the money that you give when you join Max Fun is money that goes straight to the shows that you listen to. Like, it's not like, I think sometimes people imagine that there's like a big pot of money and I'm like Jabba the Hutt with like a line of people coming to see me with their hands outstretched and I get to decide. But actually, you, the listener, get to decide. Like, when you join, you tell us what shows you listen to, and that's who the money goes to. A new venture like this needs your support, so I hope folks will go to MaximumFund.org/join. And they can get stuff, too.
They can get stuff. We're asking you to consider joining at the $10 a month level. You get the Depression Mode pin. You know, I always say this is like the whole pin thing. It's like Olympic athletes trading pins back and forth. But since yes. It's for our show, skip the athletic part. Just sit on your couch in your sweatpants, and you can still do it. You also get the bonus content. We did a taping about mental health and television in cooperation with the Dead Pilot Society podcast, where I talked with Rachel Bloom from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
A hero, friend and hero.
Yes. Stephen Canals, the creator of Pose, was part of it. It was a fascinating show, so that's available. And then the commentary track for the movie Destroy All Monsters, where you get to basically watch the silliest Japanese monster movie with me and John Hodgman, the judge himself.
Your friend and mine. It just goes to show, like, this is an extraordinary community of people, like all kinds of people. But I think the thing that ties everybody together is kindness and caring. You know, like I have so rarely found any interaction with anyone in the Max Fun community that's short on those things. And I'm very proud that we can be the locus for those kinds of feelings. And that's, you know, that's the reason that Depression Mode is part of Max Fun. We knew that the work that you do would resonate with Max Funsters, and we knew that the work that you do was perfect for the way that we do business.
It ultimately comes down to this idea of the team that we all play a role on. I mean, I always say, like, I'm the one, I happen to be the guy who talks into the microphone the most. But there, you know, there's Gabe, there's Laura, there's you, there's people at Maximum Fun doing their part. There's Rhett Miller, who wrote our amazing theme music. And part of that team is the listeners and people giving feedback. A lot of our listeners appear on the show. You know, it's part of the same team. Keep the team going. We ask you as a listener to also be a supporter. And that's what we need. That's what we need to keep going. And it's so inspirational that everyone's a part of that. They're part of that teamwork. I think eventually we'll need to get some sort of satin team jackets with our names stitched on the top there. And I think we'll really be onto something at that point, too.
Yeah, possibly bowling shirts. We're working on some different ideas. Yeah. This is my challenge to your audience, and it's to a specific part of your audience. I know that there's folks who have followed you from Wits to the hilarious world of Depression, now to Depression Mode. I know there are folks that have a relationship with your work, and those folks, you know, when Hilarious World of Depression ended, were contacting me like, you got to find a way to save John Moe's show. And I'm sure they were contacting you, John. And what those folks often asked me was like, what can I do? What can I do? What can I do? Yeah. To make this a sustainable, long-term thing? And the answer to that question, if you're somebody who has gotten a lot from John's work over a really long period of time, is this is your chance. You have a direct button to push that will support this show, make it a long-term success, make it sustainable in the long term. And that is your, you know, $5 a month or $10 a month, $20 a month, whatever is within your means. But go to MaximumFun.org/join. And you can be part of the, you know, the kind of scaffolding that supports this show for a long time so that it can do the things that it has probably already done for your life and do it for you and for other folks.
You can join, you can keep it strong for yourself, and you can make it available to others. So often we hear that the show, you know, gets sent around, links get sent around. My mom sent me this, my kids sent me this, my friend sent me this. And it really connected. So you can be a part of that network as well. And thank you if you have. As Jesse says, MaximumFun.org/join is the place to go. Jesse, thank you so much.
Thank you, John. It's nice to talk to you in a context other than slightly drunk at a public radio conference.
Back with Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Peter was talking about borrowing the idea of one day at a time from the recovery community. In his case, at the worst of his depression, it was don't die by suicide today.
I'm very happy to say that I am years away from these days. Mm-hmm. Things got better significantly and some time ago. So I'm talking about, in a weird way, I have to conjure up what this felt like. But in a weird way, there are lessons that I've been able to carry forward. If you don't, for example, if you have no faith that the future is going to get any better, that your horizon is now limited to a day, like I'm going to get through this day, then if you're somebody like me who has spent way too much time in my life worrying about what the future will hold, will I succeed, will I fail, what will happen, what is before me, it's almost liberating. I'll get through this day. I won't worry about my future success or whether I'll ever find, or it just, you just, and all of a sudden you realize that that long-term worrying has been a source of great anxiety and fear. So you put that aside. And then another thing happens, which is that you start thinking of your interactions with the world in terms of your, in terms of the shortest time frame. And what I mean by that is the worst times I have behaved towards other people, or rather I should say, the times where I have behaved toward other people in the worst way, it is almost because of anxiety about what's going to happen. If I don't stand up for myself, then I will be, you know, I'm going to yell at this person because if I don't establish my dominance, then down the road, whatever is going to happen. You know, if I don't like assert my position, if I don't, you know, get in good with this person and suck up to them, then maybe, you know, if I do that, you know, maybe, and I'm not proud of that either, then maybe that person will invite me into their project or whatever. Mm-hmm. If you stop thinking about that, then all of a sudden you start thinking about your interactions with people just in terms of the moment, in which, at least in my case, freed me up to do what I had always should have done, which is just to be kind in the moment. Focus more about that person in the moment rather than what that person might do to me or against me unless I act now. So in a weird way, and I should have thought more about this before I started talking about it, this kind of destruction of my future prospects, if only because of the nature of my psychopathology to begin with, I think in a weird way made me a better person. And it even translates into my relationship, now my marriage. When I met Mara, now my wife, for whatever reason, well, in my case, because I was involved in this horrific divorce and this nightmare situation with my children, and for her, because of her own reasons and her own recent experience, when we first met, we were like, well, this isn't going to be like a long-term thing. We're just going to hang out with each other when we want to, and we're not going to put any expectations on it, you know, because it's not going to work out. Neither of us are into long-term things, and now we're married and have a child, and I do not think that that's an accident. I think that if either of us, I know for myself, if I had immediately started sizing her up as a potential like long-term partner, a potential second marriage, a potential rebound relationship, things would have gone to shit early. But because we both, for whatever reason, just decided to take it one more time, one day at a time, we actually treated each other in a much more healthy way, if I'm making any sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It strikes me that through the worst thing that could be imagined, the loss of your family, you arrived at this place where like Buddhist monks attain,
yeah,
or seek to go, or what meditation's all about, which is I am here right now. I always compare it to dogs. Like we're always trying to get to the immediate in the momentness that dogs innately have. And you got there just through a very different road and through a really bad part of town.
Yes, exactly right. I sometimes think about the fact, one of the things I think about a lot is that for everything I went through, and it was pretty bad and remains pretty bad in many ways, it was worth it because I genuinely feel I came out of it as a better person. I hope the people who know me agree. I don't know. But it is my hope that it was a struggle. There were some moves forward. There were some moves back. But I've ended up being a better person in terms of just how I deal with other people, because A, I don't care nearly as much about the shit I used to care about. B, I no longer worry so much about like the long-term, like what am I going to get from this person? It doesn't matter to me anymore. My only concern these days and when I deal with other people is I just try to be as genuinely kind to them as I can in the moment. And in a way that a dog is. And I think, without getting too self-congratulatory, it also has a lot to do with the fact that when you lose as much as I think I have lost, I know I've lost, you start focusing on the important things. Mm-hmm. And I think I've been able to do that to a certain extent.
And has the depression, has the anxiety problems, did that fade? Did that slowly recede or was it going strong the whole time?
I mean, I've been obviously like any person with our mutual problem, it will always be there, but I have to admit that it hasn't been nearly as bad as it was. And I consider that for a number of reasons. A, medication, which I didn't finally get on until around 2012. That's helped a lot. Let's not dismiss that. But frankly, it also has to do with my extricating myself from what even I think my ex would agree was a toxic marriage. in which many of the dynamics both triggered and exacerbated the symptoms of my depression. I mean, when people would talk to me about, you know, my first marriage, I'd say, well, basically, I'd always spent my life worried whether I whether or not I was a piece of shit, so I decided to marry somebody who was sure. And so getting myself out of that and into a much, much healthier relationship helped tremendously. I mean, everybody knows that you can't be talked out of depression. Mm-hmm. It's a cliche in the discourse that nobody can tell you not to be depressed. It doesn't work that way, and I agree. But man, it really helps to be with someone whose view of you is so much better than your view of yourself. Mm. And if you work at it, you can get to the point where instead of arguing with that person, or, and this is something I used to do, holding that person in vague contempt because they're foolish enough to think that you're admirable, to actually find yourself wanting to prove that person right. In which we get back to another cliche about dogs, is be the person that your dog thinks you are. And with all respect to my lovely wife, I discovered that instead of, you know, thinking somebody, in her case, it was a fool for liking me and thinking I was admirable, I decided to entertain her in that delusion and devote some effort into making sure she never figures out the truth.
So when this first became apparent that Mara thought you were okay, did you just not believe her? Did you think, oh, what a fool?
It's hard to say. I mean, we had an immediate connection in a way that I didn't think was really possible. That, I mean, you know, it's, if we want to talk about delusions of invoked by popular culture, we can talk about true love. And all of a sudden, I'm actually having one of those relationships that had I seen it on TV or film, I would have gone, oh, come on. And that was true from the beginning, I'm proud to say. But, you know, basically it was, I think it was, again, just a sense of this isn't going to matter. I don't need to be this person. I don't need this person to be A or B or C. I don't have to mind any imagined flaws of D, E, or F because nothing's going to happen. It's all just in the moment. And at least in my case, both I think my judgmental mind was put at ease, and maybe also the parts of me that are more easily judged were banished for the moment. And so there was an ease to it for the most part. It hasn't been flawless, that had never been present before. And I think it's because I had always worried so much about everything.
Well, it sounds like you weren't putting your self-regard in her hands, which is a really healthy thing to do. And probably,
yes,
probably a little more likely to happen with someone who's been around the block a few times as you have.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. I mean, I didn't. And it's weird to describe because if my wife were to come down and tell me right now that she doesn't care for me anymore and that she's done with me and she thinks I'm awful, I would be devastated. And yet at the same time, the fact that I haven't worried about that nearly as much as I have with almost every other intimate relationship I've ever had in my life has made that scenario far less likely.
Well, I think too, as a professional stage manager, she would know to walk in, not to walk in the middle of the interview.
Yeah. In addition, yes, also that, and also as a professional stage manager, she's very used to dealing with very fragile egos.
Right. Right. She's so good at performers.
She married one. she's really good at being the sane person in the room.
Yeah.
And understanding that some people just need to be a little nuts and in order to do their work. Let's put it that way.
And now there is an Elliot in the world.
There is an Elliot. Elliot Weimer Sagal, named after Mara's paternal grandfather, who she never had the opportunity to meet. But we've heard wonderful things about. Two L's, uh-huh. Two T's. Don't get it wrong. I have.
I hate to ask this because I feel like I'm asking it because you're older and because you've had a family before. Whereas if you were 25, nobody would ask why you're having a baby because it's what people do.
Right.
But I'm going to ask it anyway and know that I'm a terrible person for asking it. Why a baby now?
Why a baby now? Mainly, let me put it this way. It was a very different choice for Mara than for myself. Mara is younger than I am. She has not had a child in the way that I have. But she made her own journey to the acceptance that that's what she wanted. For me, it was more complicated because I had three children. And it had not gone well. The after-action report on my parenting was very poor. I certainly don't think that the feedback forms as filed by my extant children would have been very positive in terms of recommending that other people should try my services as a father. So that was something to struggle with. And there was also the sense of, when you're so concerned about regaining what you've lost, is it okay to move on to something else, right? Mm-hmm. Another child, another family. But that ended up, let me put it this way. My decision started as an act of what I thought of as generosity toward my wife, i.e., I have children, she doesn't. Who am I to deny her what turns out to be a deep desire of hers just because I've already done it? I'm not going to do that, right? You know, if your wife wanted to see Paris and she never has and you've seen Paris, you're not going to say, I've already been there. No, you'd take her to Paris. Mm-hmm. To expand that to a much more significant life choice, just because you've had children is no excuse to prevent your wife from having a child if that's what she wants, and that's what she ended up wanting. So that's fine. It started that way. What it ended up being is getting back to what we were discussing earlier, to discover what a real happy ending is. And a real happy ending in this life, maybe for some people it works out differently, but in my experience so far, a real happy ending is not getting back what you lost in spades, getting the roast beast and all the Christmas presents down from Mount Crumpet, but moving on and hopefully getting something else. And so having the short version of all this is, having lost my prior family, I now have a new one. And I've come to understand that is the absolute best anybody can hope for in this earth. And again, I am a lucky man.
I always say that at the end of The Grinch, it works out great for everybody except the Beast.
Yeah, the Beast. No one ever thinks about the Beast.
No.
The Beast was the Beast. I mean,
it wasn't always roasted. It was just a beast walking around.
Wouldn't it be bizarre if there was like an original like director's cut in which the Beast were alive when the Grinch stole it, and the Beast was like, "I'm saved, I'm saved. I won't be slaughtered by the Who's and served up at their feast." And he's up there at the top of Mount Crumpet. And he's like, "This is great. I can live up here. I'm a furry mammal. I can exist." And then all of a sudden, the Grinch is like, "No, we're going back."
Yeah, we're going back down, and the Beast is like, are they lighting an oven down there?
What's terrible. Wait a minute.
I see some smoke coming out of there.
You saved me. God.
I've wanted to always do like a series of children's books for depressed children. I mean, I guess that's what Edward Gorey did already. But
yes.
You know, it's sort of the same thing.
B is for Beast who died of the Who's.
More with Peter Sagal in just a few moments. But first, as I said earlier, this is the Max Fund Drive. This is when everybody comes together to support the shows that they love. This is how Depression Mode is able to exist. And we're coming together right now. People are coming in, helping out. And here to help me right now is a name that you might know from the credits of our show. It's senior producer Laura Swisher, The Swish. Hey, Laura.
Hello, John.
I am so excited for this, our first Max Fun Drive, so we can gather teammates and gather support. And I'm so excited to build a new show with you.
I was so excited to find out that you were looking for a new network. And as you know, our managing director was the one who like turned me onto it. And so I started listening to A Hilarious World of Depression to get a feel for the type of show this could be. And I was blown away. I thought just to be able to hear honest conversations that don't feel like they're prescriptive, but they're just people talking, I think is just so valuable. And I'm just so glad that you're part of Maximum Fun.
Well, it's been a heck of a year, you know, for everybody. And even if you have a diagnosis or if you don't have a diagnosis, everybody's got some obstacles going on right now, I think. And what we try to do is bring those conversations out into the open, make them entertaining, make them informative, make them useful in the daily experience of having a mind in the present day, because it's historically been this idea that mental health should never be talked about in public. There's a lot of shame about it. There's a lot of stigma to it, and we're doing things a little different. And now it's time for you to do your part, dear Depression Mode listener, preshies.
Oh, I like that.
You like that? I'm working on
Preshies,
that
one. Yeah.
Every time I say my Preshies, someone sends me a picture of Gollum. But, you know, you listen to the show, you know that it helps you and it helps others and it helps society, especially during this time when we need all the help we can get. Support from people just like you, coming together, forming a team, putting your name on the roster. That's how the show's able to exist. I mean, I have my part in doing the interviews and the writing. Gabe puts the shows together. Laurie, you're tackling some big picture stuff for the show. We're all doing our part for the team. And now it's up to you, the listener, to do your part, make it possible. Together, we're going to build a community that does good in the world. So go to MaximumFun.org/join.
And I, on the theme of community, I was struck by when you first came to the network, you were raring to go. Like you had so many ideas.
To launch that night.
Yeah, you wanted to launch that night. You had guest ideas. You had topic ideas. And I was just so impressed with your actual interest, your need to want to communicate this. And the relationships that you've developed with all your listeners, you have created a community. I guess Thwadballs is what mm-hmm. they were called. And I, you know, in reading some of the comments on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, I would see people just, they're so happy that you were back. I want you to be supported for all the work that you've put into it.
Well, it's the most important thing I can think to do with the abilities that I have. It's the most important use of my time I could think of. And it's really exciting because I think there's a lot of people coming together to be a part of it with me. And it's, you know, starting a new show, you get to be one of the sort of founding supporters of the show, know that you're making this thing possible and you're making it possible to keep going. But Laura, you also can get stuff, right? So if you join at MaximumFun.org/join, we have a pin. We are officially part of the Piniverse. We have the Depression Mode pin available, and you also get bonus content. So we have, you want me to tell you about the bonus content?
I want to hear what your pin is.
Oh, it is the sort of smiley frowny icon from our logo, from our tile. So you get that little guy. And you get the intrigue of people looking at it as it's pinned to your lapel or hat or wherever you want to put it. And, you know, it's a little code. It's a little, it's like a hobo sign carved onto a barn. Like, so, we can recognize each other in the wild.
The pins are traditionally very popular. If anyone is so inclined, you want the Depresh Mode pin, you can get that by joining or upgrading to $10 a month. That will get you the pin. Even if you're not able to do $10 a month, there's $5 a month, and $5 a month, you get bonus content. And that's actually, you have some great bonus content, but in addition to what you're about to tell us, they get access to every show on the network's bonus content, and as well as like all the past shows. So it's hundreds of hours of great, amazing content. But so I know, what did you do this year? Because it's very exciting.
I'm coming out of the gate hot. I was so excited. So we're doing a crossover episode with the Dead Pilots Society podcast. And I'm going to moderate a panel of TV writers talking about mental illness on the screen, on television. And so we're going to have Rachel Bloom from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. She's part of that. Stephen Canals, who's the creator of the show Pose, which is such a wonderful show. Yeah, I know. And so that's going to be a really illuminating thing because there's better and better portrayal of mental illness going on with some of these pioneers as an antidote to some of the real trash portrayals that have existed in years past. And then another one, I'm doing a special movie commentary track. I'll be wisecracking along with Judge John Hodgman to the 1968 Japanese horror classic Destroy All Monsters. And if you've never seen this, Swish.
I have never seen this.
Oh my God. Godzilla, Rodan, Mothra, people in big rubbery suits, people in space helmets, lots and lots of people running around and smashing model buildings. It is glorious.
That sounds great. I'm in.
You're in. See? It's there. It's strong. Join our team. MaximumFun.org/join. It's super easy to do, and we appreciate your support. Thank you, Swish.
You're welcome. Thanks, John.
Do you think about parenting and marriage now as an act of atonement? Do you see it as, I screwed up and now take two, I'm going to be better at it?
I don't think of it as an act of atonement in the sense that I don't owe anybody anything for my prior sins in the way that you think of that. I do, however, believe that just as I feel that I am a much, 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 much better husband now that I have made every mistake as a husband can make in my prior marriage, I hopefully will be a much, 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 much better father than I was. Ditto. Mm-hmm. I mean, was I a complete disaster as a father? I don't think so, despite what some people might tell you. But I certainly have benefited from, I certainly made mistakes of priority, for example. The things that I thought were more important than being with my child at the moment, back when I was a father of young children for the first time, just horrify me that I had ever made that mistake. And hopefully I won't make those mistakes again. Mistakes of impatience, mistakes of giving into anger. You know, every father, every parent has done it. Every parent has gotten angry at a child. But I plan at least never to do that again with my son. And because it's not important, whatever it may be. So it's not so much like, oh, I need to make it up to the world but to be a better father. It's that I'm in a position to be a much better father than I think I was before. And that is because of the mistakes I have made. I was listening to somebody just the other day saying the only wisdom in this world is wisdom you get through mistakes and through trial. Everything else is just pretense. And I think, at least in my case, that's true. Sometimes I can't even believe that I was asked to be a husband and a father without having been through it before. I mean, there should be like some intense training session before they allow you to do it.
Right. Yeah, you just, anybody can do it. You just sign up.
Yeah, you know.
You described this time coming out of the divorce, a long walk through the desert that you're describing. Yes. And the whole time you're on the air on this popular comedy show.
Yes.
And like, what did that teach you about who you at the root were and what comedy means in your life?
That's a really good question. We talked earlier, and I don't want to repeat that, about how, you know, faking it till you make it turns out to be valuable, how pretending to be cheerful, how making a smile when you don't feel it can actually affect your mood. Mm-hmm. But I'll tell you, and this also has to do with the pandemic as well, is I like to think that my comedy, to the extent that I'm a comedian, has become a lot kinder. Because my attitude towards performing, my attitudes towards doing my job have significantly changed. And I think it has changed both in my relationship with my audience and with my colleagues. And what I mean by that is this, is that there's a very, as you know, an aggressive aspect to comedy. In comedy, people talk about killing an audience or dying if you don't kill. And it can also be very competitive. There's so many, these days especially, there are so many people doing what we do and have wanted to do. There's a sense of various ladders you want to climb and trying to get ahead in this world that we live in. To a certain extent, I've benefited from the fact that I've now aged out of a lot of ambition, so that's become a bit of a relief. But at the same time, I've also become much more enamored of comedy that isn't about that kind of aggressiveness, either toward the audience or about your subject. And I've become enamored of this idea of comedy as a form of togetherness or a form of bonding.
Right.
Because instead of killing an audience, you're hoping to invite an audience into a shared moment. That, you know, I was once invited to give a lecture on what I thought was funny, and I came up with this, which is that, you know, whenever you tell somebody about something funny that happened, right? Oh, we were at work, and then somebody said this, and somebody said that, and then somebody said this, and then the person looks at you blankly, and you always say, well, you kind of had to be there. That's the cliche. And if you dig down, what you mean by that is If you were there, there was a group of people in that room, maybe in that theater, if it's, you're talking about a performance, who for 1 second, because of the surprise and delight of something that happened, the performance, the joke, the accident, were all there together, living the moment exactly together. They had all been brought out of their heads. My friend Chris Ware, the cartoonist, says that everybody has the habit of narrating their own lives all the time as if it were a novel. So you're always thinking about what just happened and what's going to happen next. When a moment of comedy delight happens, everybody's kicked out of that and you're all there together and you're all watching the thing together. It's why I think you and I both came out of the theater and still love the theater, why you and your shows have tried to do live shows, why I do a live show, because you're all there together. And when something happens, it is a commonality and a bonding and a sharing that is not hostile and not aggressive, but benign and welcoming and joyful. And I have gotten far, far more interested in that kind of, in that use of comedy. I'm not as much interested in being the sharpest or the meanest or the most brilliant kind of take on any given topic. I'm much more interested in bringing people something more akin to joy.
I wonder if you'd be able to compartmentalize as effectively as you can now if it was a few years ago. I wonder if you use those skills better now.
I absolutely think I do. I really do. Because I, as we discussed again before, I kind of had to. I couldn't bring all the trauma that was going on in my personal life when it was at its peak to my job because I couldn't do my job. You know, I would have been standing there at the podium weeping. So I had to like, nope, can't think about that. Got to think about this. And that is another learned skill. There had been days in the long, distant past where I wasn't able to do that. And it really affected my performance and it really affected the show. So you just had to learn to put that aside. So yeah, that is absolutely a learned skill. And there's nothing wrong with compartmentalization.
It's necessary to live.
Exactly.
So if I have to ask about your mental health today, like we know that something like depression isn't like, it doesn't go away like an ear infection. But where is it today? Where is your mental health today?
My mental health is, I am pleased and almost scared to say, better than it's ever been. And I think that has a function of a lot of things. I really do think that to a certain extent, I was really profoundly affected by what I went through. And I think I like to think, I hope the people in my life will agree that I came out of it a better person than I went into. It gave me perspective, gave me a sense of patience with the world and its problems that I never would have had before. The entire idea of don't sweat the small stuff and it's all small stuff was proven to me over and over again. So that helps. Having, for really the first time in my life, a genuinely healthy, mutually supportive relationship is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Being old enough to appreciate what you have as opposed to worry about what you're not going to get or what you don't have yet is a blessing. With age, at least in my case, comes some wisdom and peace. And finally, having a small child really focuses, it's hard to be selfish and self-involved, or at least it should be, when you have a small child to take care of. So where once, let me put it this way, how best to express this? I used to waste a lot of time worrying about the future. And now I spend more profitably time creating the future. And that's a better way to be.
How's your sleep?
Not bad, weirdly. You know, I've had the same kind of anxiety sleep problems that everybody else had. Particularly, it manifests in really weird dreams. Does anybody else have this problem? I think it's because we're not getting enough input from the rest of the world, so our brain has to make up for it at night, so our dreams become crazy. But my sleep is okay. I'm doing fine. I really am.
Peter Sagal, thank you so much and best to your family.
Thank you, John. Best to yours. And I look forward to you someday starting a third podcast in which I can be a guest on that.
That's right. It's a tradition after all.
We get
into these
years,
patterns with mental
health. It's a new podcast. Yeah. I show up. Right. It's great.
Yep. Well, you know, your show will run as long as nobody tells you.
Exactly.
It's built right into the name.
It's the day. I mean, it's almost like an ancient Egyptian curse. The day that someone arises to tell us, then it shall crumble into dust.
Shall crumble, and only Mo Rocca shall remain.
Exactly.
I think I'm starting to understand Peter Sagal's brain a little bit more after all these years. One, because he's my friend. Two, because I've interviewed him a few times. And three, because I recognize some stuff. I think we get along as friends, and I enjoy interviewing him in part because our brains are similar. I've been told that I intellectualize things like situations, relationships, my mental health, which doesn't mean not feeling them. You still feel them intensely. It's just that you also run them back through your head a lot. Sometimes late at night when you're trying to sleep, you analyze, you theorize, you experiment. Your brain becomes like a Large Hadron emotional super collider. And it can make things worse. I think it can make your actual psychic being into more of an English paper, and it can separate you from lived experience. But I also believe it can help. Yes, I am taking a stand in favor of intellectualizing in some situations. I think it helped for Peter Sagal. It can give you a little separation when that is helpful, and it can give you the confidence of solving a bit of a mystery that is your mind. Wait, wait, don't tell me. Let me figure it out. Next time on Depression Mode, you have millions of fans, billions of views of your videos you make with your friends, you have a number one best-selling book, sold-out tours, you're a huge success in every way. Here's the challenge. Can you still nullify all your achievements and make yourself feel like garbage?
John, I have the ultimate cheat code. I have millions of followers on a on an art form platform, YouTube, that we all, I think, societally agree is not high art, right? Mm. That is at least what we think of it right now. So I have all these followers. So great, they're going to go buy my book. So I'm a number one New York Times bestseller. But,
it doesn't count.
Got all this. Yeah. Doesn't count. You know, I went on I have a podcast, whatever. It feels like cheating.
Zach Kornfeld of the Try Guys joins me. And again, we are in our very rare but very necessary fundraising period here on Depression Mode and at Maximum Fund. It's the Max Fund Drive. I can keep making these episodes of Depression Mode about mental health and the obstacles therein as long as it is supported by people like you. That is the business arrangement. I want to do that. I want to keep making those. I plan to because I think you understand that it's worth paying for what you like, for what you love. It's worth it to be on a team, even if it's just at the $10 per month level. You get the snazzy pin, you get the bonus content, and most of all, you get to help the world by helping everyone learn more about mental health and making it not such a scary topic. Depression Mode is a small organization. We depend on your help. Now is the time to help us out. MaximumFun.org/join. We love it when you recommend Depression Mode to friends. It might help them. Also, something that matters a whole lot, be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write reviews, download those episodes. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations happening. Depression Mode is your show, too. Let us know who you want me to interview, what issues you want to hear more about. We want your requests. Email us, depressionmode@maximumfun.org. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. I do notes and analysis of every episode we do, as well as some just fun, dumb things on there as well. I'm on Twitter at John Moe, all one word, same on Instagram. I sometimes wonder who listens to the credits. If you're listening to the credits, I like you. If you need it, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is at 1-800-273-8255, free 24/7. That number is also available immediately if you Google the word suicide. Thank you, Google, for that. 1-800-273-TALK. To reach the crisis text line, text the word HOME to 740-740. I'm so glad you were here to listen to the show. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. The Swish. Our theme song, Building Wings, is written and recorded by Rhett Miller.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out. Building wings, building wings, building wings.
This is Shanna from Baltimore, and I believe in you.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.